Hello, everyone, and welcome to this edition of Next Witness, Please. We're a podcast that decodes legal jargon. We try to put it in understandable, everyday terms for just regular folks. Our goal is to build understanding about the law and our legal systems. I'm retired Judge Tom Hodson. I'm joined by my colleague, friend, co-host, retired Judge Gail Williams Byers. And today we're going to take a look at the Supreme Court of the United States, a little bit about how it works and some of the major controversies facing the Supreme Court right now. Judge Gail, you ready to talk Supreme Court?
I am so ready to talk about the highest court in the land.
Well, let me just give a brief background for people who may not know, and if it's repetitive, bear with me. I won't take very long to do it. The Supreme Court is 9 justices. They're appointed by the President of the United States when there is a vacancy, and confirmed by the United States Senate. Once a justice is appointed and confirmed, the justice is on the court for life. Now, what it says technically is that they're on the court for a period of good behavior, but that means that you've got to be indicted and convicted probably of some crime before you would ever be removed. So justices are there for a long time. Many people say that it is the greatest power, one of the greatest powers of the presidency, is to appoint justices to the court. Former President Trump, appointed 3 justices to the court, which has shifted the balance of the court way to the conservative side, as we saw 2 years ago with the Dobbs decision overruling the Roe versus Wade decision. We're doing this on Friday at the end of June. We're recording this Monday, July 1st, will be the last day of the term, and the court is issuing all kinds of major decisions. So we're talking about a powerful instrument of government where people are appointed and appointed for life. Courts can have characterizations, they can be conservative, they can be liberal, they can be middle of the road. This court is hyper-conservative, and we're seeing that in the rulings that are rolling out of the court here in the last week of decision-making. Judge Gail, the court in the past has had one of the strongest reputations of any government agency in the sense of public trust. People have trusted the court to be the arbiter of the Constitution and to make decisions based upon the law and not politics. However, the recent polls show that the court's trust ratio is plummeting, and it's at the lowest point ever. What do you say about that?
Well, I think it's terribly unfortunate that the court now struggles with very low approval ratings from the public that relies upon it to make decisions that impact and affect the daily lives of everyone. But I also think that we are at a particular state or time in history that we'll look back on, and we may very well in another maybe 2, 3, or 4 generations wonder whether or not it remains the best practice to have justices that serve for a lifetime as opposed for a designated or particularized period of time. I say that because I genuinely believe that although there are multiple reasons for the low approval ratings and what I like to call the erosion of trust in not just the Supreme Court, but in the justice system as a whole, because it all trickles down. And so far as there's lack of trust in the Supreme Court, you can best believe that that also translates into an erosion or a lack of or diminished faith or trust in your local court and your local judges. And that is impactful. It's important to understand how that perception transcends so many things. But with that being said, I know that as time marches on, things change. And I think there's a public that asks whether or not justices that are appointed for a lifetime, who may in fact bring with them the wisdom of their experience and their background, are also keeping pace with the requirements and the desires and the changes in the society that they so directly impact. Meaning, are they really keeping up with all the things that are affecting the lives of the folks whose decisions are directly affected by them? Take, you know, the Dobbs decision, for example, and no matter which side you fall on it or not, understand that after 5+ decades, you build in the people who rely on this court, you build up in them a reliance that they can rely on and they can trust and that they can know that the decisions the court has made are going to be there and they're going to be mainstays and that they should not expect these huge swings or changes. You have grandparents whose lives are going to be, would have been vastly different from now, their own grandchildren because of the change in the composition of the court and now the, you know, the perspective and the opinions of those judges that are making those decisions. And all of those things impact whether or not folks believe they can actually trust the court itself, not the least of which is the whole ethical components that come along with the backdrop that may have absolutely nothing to do with the cases themselves, but they also have everything to do with how people view, respect, and perceive the institution, the court itself, and the folks who are there representing the institution, i.e. the justices. So if the justices are not perceived to be trustworthy, honorable people who have integrity and follow the rules, or are not, you know, perhaps frequently moving the goalposts to their own, what's perceived to be their own benefit, when you have that, then you certainly have folks who wonder, you know, what's the point? What's the benefit of even having a Supreme Court whose rules you have to follow when perhaps they don't follow the rules that they set out for everybody else? And that's troubling. I think that's worthy of a deeper conversation, right? Because that's really the one that folks are having. They may or may not ever read the opinions that come out of the court itself. Now, they know the impact of many of these opinions, but they may never read all of the multiple pages of the opinions, but they do ingest the headlines that remind them or frequently inform them of the behavior, the outside behavior of the decision makers. And if they don't expect anything, remember, Thomas, judges, if people don't expect anything, they expect judges to be above it all. They expect for perhaps members of Congress to, you know, engage in certain behavior that may be a little salty or, you know, unbecoming, and maybe they color outside the lines a little bit. They even expect that from the executive branch. But the judiciary has always been considered different. There's always been a higher expectation for it. And by and large, the judiciary itself has found it important to rise to the occasion and to meet the moment each and every time. And I think the low approval rating is in a direct result of maybe not meeting the moment on more than several occasions.
Let me jump in here because the next president, the one we elect in November of 2024, will most likely have two appointments to the court. Clarence Thomas is getting up in age. He may very well retire. Justice Alito also may be on the cusp of leaving the court. So it's very important in the next presidential race who the president is and what the court would look like after that. So right now, it's basically a 5-3, arch conservative 5-3 liberal justices, with the chief justice being somewhere in the middle, floating back and forth. So if, let's say former President Trump is elected, he can point two more conservatives. Really looking at the age of the person appointed, let's say you appoint somebody in their 40s, that person could be on the court for 40 years.
Well, yeah, actually, if you think about it.
40 years.
Four now, decades. And that's one of that's the a people, long time.
One of the people they're talking about him perhaps appointing would be Aileen Cannon, the judge in Florida covering the Mar-a-Lago case. You know, if you appoint somebody young, they can influence the constitutional interpretation or the interpretation of the Constitution for us average folk out here for the next 4-5 decades. So it's incredibly important, regardless of your political stripe. If you want to do that, then, you know, President Trump may be the one. If you're looking at maybe bringing balance to the court, then you may be looking at President Biden or whomever the Democrats put up for the presidency. But it's become that political, and it's before we even get to the ethics, it's the politics indeed of this that are so critical, and people don't seem to understand it, and I want to make sure that they do. It's one of the greatest powers of the presidency.
Indeed, and also consider the fact, as you mentioned, I mean, and rightfully pointed out, the politics of the appointment process. And in addition to the politics of the appointment process is also the politics of the confirmation process, right? So the president has the power to appoint. Congress through the Senate has the responsibility to confirm. We saw this many times over with the appointment of Supreme Court justices, whether it's Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, whose
Amy
confirmation hearing was well televised, Justice Coney Barrett, and Justice Jackson.
Way back when, Clarence Thomas.
Yes, and I was going to say, if we reach back to Justice Thomas, way back in the Bush years, because he was appointed by President Bush, and that was very similar to the hearing that Justice Kavanaugh endured, and in part because of similar concerns. But remember, you know, even before the confirmation hearing takes place, there is an entire vetting process. There's a shepherding process that goes on Capitol Hill, where judicial appointments are scheduled to meet with members of Congress because they must be confirmed by a majority vote. And
But before that, Judge, they're vetted by groups like the Heritage Foundation,
indeed,
and various arch conservative groups.
If they're conservative,
to then have a short list that the president then goes forward with. So they're vetted by all these other agencies, not on their judicial philosophy, but on their politics.
And indeed, that I think has been. That has been largely historical, but I'll say more recent have we known the role that certain organizations play in providing these recommendations to presidents, right? So as you mentioned, the Heritage Foundation, certainly presidents themselves, I don't think are doing, you know, personal deep dives into the backgrounds of judges such that they're making these decisions. Rarely are decisions made in a silo. And there are times when even appointed or recommended justice candidates are withdrawn. And you can either the president themselves will withdraw it or the candidate themselves will withdraw. I think, you know, one of the greatest ironies is Attorney General Garland, who was actually nominated for appointment by then President Barack Obama. And it was the then head of the Senate, the majority leader of the Senate, then Senator Mitch McConnell, who refused to provide then appellate Judge Garland a confirmation hearing. So he never got an opportunity to even go through the process. And only after President Biden was elected did Judge Garland then leave the bench to now become the U.S. Attorney General. So he still ended up going through a confirmation process, but it wasn't for the position that he had originally been identified for. But I would suspect he had already been vetted, thoroughly vetted for the appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court by the team that handled it during the Obama administration. And so that made for a really easy option for President Biden when it came time to select an attorney general. And so, again, as you said, these things are highly, highly political. The amount of work and research that is done into someone's background to determine their political ideologies. And this, again, this has very little to do with capabilities, right? There's not a whole lot of connectivity, if you will, between someone's ability to actually do the work versus what their stance is on certain issues, and then the ability to rely on them to make decisions consistent with those positions, those articulated stances, or those ideologies. That's what the political vetting and process is and what it does. And then at the same time, I genuinely believe that during this process, certain assurances are made that either, you know, there will be commitments to those ideologies or not. And then that is what begins the process of calling or collecting those senatorial votes that are necessary for final confirmation. And you're right. You know, if there are certain organizations that have already identified candidates they think are better suited for this, then they also have done the vote counting. So they know also the members of Congress who have certain ideologies themselves, who lean a certain way, who are inclined to think or vote or support certain stances. So those votes are pretty much in the bank at the time the candidate is put forward.
The court. So one of the aspects of the court's decline in public trust, I think, started back with the Gore-Bush decision after the election, which the court gave to George W. Bush.
However, wasn't that interesting, right? So we didn't have votes counted necessarily by the people. We had a court that decided who our next president was and stopped the vote counting.
Which it really started the political nature of the court. It brought it into focus. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just gone downhill from there to where we now don't have public trust based on politics. The second aspect of public trust is based on ethics. And let's talk about the ethics of the court. Now, for our listeners out there, every judge, whether you're the lowest level trial judge in a state or the highest level judge in the federal system, in the circuit courts of appeals, all up and down the line, judges' behaviors, their finances are regulated by codes of judicial conduct. If you violate those codes as a judge, you run the risk of being removed from office and possibly other disciplinary action taken against your law license. The codes of ethics of judges really are strongly adhered to, but I'd say 98-99% of the judges or more across the country. However, and part of all of those codes of ethics, I should say, is that they're enforceable, as I said, with disciplinary action or suspension or disbarment. The Supreme Court, until just recently, had no code of ethics. The one they decided that they would follow just recently, this term, they said, well, it's not enforceable, so nobody pays a damn bit of attention to it. Now, we've got two justices who are in the crosshairs of ethical situations. Clarence Thomas, for accepting millions of dollars in gratuities, in trips, in travel lodges, motorhomes, and all kinds of things from people who may have some business before the court at some point. Not only did he accept those, but they went unreported on his listing of gifts and incomes that each justice has to report each and every year. That has to take a toll on public trust, does it not?
Tom, you make it sound like there's something wrong with what you were describing. Are you serious? So yes, I do agree that it takes a toll. And you said something so important earlier, which was, you know, that Bush Gore decision kind of seemed to be kind of the beginning of the end, as you describe it, for the reputation of the Supreme Court, you know, causing the, you know, continued downward spiral. I would say that there's an awful lot of daylight between that incident or that situation with Butch Gore and what we've been seeing, hearing, learning in, I would say, the last, you know, 9 to 12 months of the behavior of the current justices as seated on the court, that we've gone from, you know, downhill to literally off a cliff. I mean, there's, you know, so much to absorb when we talk about the ethical responsibilities, the dealing in integrity, in truthfulness and transparency. The belief is here that if you elect, for whatever reason, to throw your hat into the ring of public service and to then decide that you are going to commit your talents for the good of the public, that you also commit that you will not engage in self-dealing, that you will be above board, that your life will essentially be an open book, that you, although you may have access to certain information, you will never use it for the benefit of yourself or for those around you. You won't make undue or unfair financial gains or any other gains because of it. You won't utilize relationships to make, you know, to again, to realize certain benefits that do not properly flow to you. It's important, especially for lawyers and judges, as you said, Tom, because every jurisdiction that governs the behavior of lawyers and judges in particular, they do so with, I like to say, a carrot and a stick, right? So the carrot is you when you do this appropriately, you are rewarded with a great reputation in the community. It can be a very lucrative profession. You bring honor to the profession and you do good work at the same time. The stick, however, is when you violate the rules, just as you've outlined, there can be, you know, a menu of options to respond to the rule violation, everything from publicly reprimanding you and reminding you that your behavior perhaps is not conformed or you've not acted consistent with the expectations of a judge, all the way up to and including disbarment, whether it's for a limited period of time or if it's permanently. And disbarment basically means removing your law license from you. The loss of your license as issued in a state or jurisdiction in order to practice law in any court or jurisdiction. That is what we like to call the nuclear option. And every judge everywhere understands that they are required to abide by these rules. And in fact, just about every judge everywhere is required also to undergo training regularly, annually or biannually, and to certify and prove that they have taken certain courses or trainings to remind them of these ethical obligations, to remind them that these are the rules that govern them, and that when they don't abide by these rules, they face, again, a menu of penalties, including up to and including the loss of their law license. So it's enough to keep you in check. It's enough to remind you that, hey, my license is my livelihood. This is the work that I've committed to doing. And in order to stay in the game, I've got to follow the rules. Now, as you've indicated, when you have the highest group of judges in the land who also help to set out the rules for everybody else, so that means not only are we looking to those justices for the integrity that they instill and for the honor to this profession that naturally flows from them, but also responding to their expectations vis-a-vis the rules that they set out for us. It just seems kind of commonsensical, right? That we wouldn't have to have conversations about them following the rules, because don't those rules or shouldn't those rules equally apply? And I think, again, back to the point of eroding trust in the court by the public, I think part of it was that whole ice bath, that shock to the system for people to learn or to find out that, hold on, wait a minute, take a beat. Are you telling me that these folks here in this court that makes decisions that affect everybody in the entire country, from Alaska to Alabama, from Mississippi to Michigan, from Tennessee to Texas, from Ohio to Oregon, these people don't have to follow rules, and the rules that they do set out, some of which may be at least seemingly begrudgingly, that they're pretty much voluntary. You mean to tell me they've been operating on the honor system all this time and we trusted their honor system, and look what the trust to that honor system has gotten? And so you have the common person who's just trying to make it from day to day saying, you have got to be kidding me. You can't believe, you mean to tell me my lawyer might get kicked off my case, and it's just about child support, if they don't do every single thing right, and they may not have a law license, but these cats over here in the highest court with the ivory pillars, they can pick and choose what rules they'll abide by. And then even then, it's like, if I feel like it, I will. That, I think, has really stunned a lot of folks.
Let me take this to the next step. We talked about Clarence Thomas in financial matters. Also, his wife is a very inside person in the Trump world, advised Trump on the January 6th matter. Then we have Justice Alito, who has flags flying at his house in support of the January 6th insurrection, and then also an extreme Christian theocracy flag flying at his beach house. So not only are there financial regulations of what you can and cannot do with money and how you do or do not need to report that money, there are other ethical obligations, and those are that you have to show that you're unbiased. You, as unbiased as you can be, the appearance of impropriety or impropriety that goes against that neutrality is frowned upon in every code of ethics, every code of ethics. But yet we have Justice Alito flying these flags, whether it's his wife or him, I don't give a damn. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter.
I absolutely agree. And I'll tell you, folks, the appearance of impropriety is really basic. It is, the derivative is improper, right? So the appearance of what is improper. And the rule isn't, hey, you've got to live your life avoiding everything that's improper. No, the rule is, listen, whether it is or isn't even the case. If it appears to be improper, you have to be so in tuned that as a judge, if it even appears to be improper, then you are required to avoid it, to stay away from it, to shun it, to correct it or resolve it. And it goes straight to your flag flying point, which is, listen, it doesn't matter that, you know, he can argue, not my flag, it's my wife's flag. She, you know, she put it up. I can't get her to take it down. Unless you don't live with your wife, unless you are not staying there, unless you all are not together, guess what? The average person walking down the street is going to look and say, that's your house. You that's live in that flag. House together. And that's so if flag. It's flying, it is the definition or the whatever perception related to that flag is going to then be imputed to both of you. Not just, nobody's going to say, oh, well, that must just be hers. That's just not, that's not his. Because he can't have an opinion, right? He's not supposed to have an opinion. He's the justice. Well, the average person won't make that distinction because they will impute that to both. And so, yeah, there are some limitations, yes, on spouses. There are certainly limitations on public servants like judges. And yes, climb your tail up that flagpole and take it down if you have to. And, or at worst, climb up the flagpole and take out a Sharpie and draw hers across the flag so that it's really clear whose voice is actually being articulated with it, because it really does punch another black eye into Lady Justice, who's supposed to be blind and doesn't know apparently that she's rolling around looking like a pirate with a black eye and constantly getting beat up.
So we have the financial aspects and others with his wife, Jenny Thomas, with Clarence Thomas. We have Alito with the flags and public statements that he made to a person surreptitiously recording him that were antithetical to judicial neutrality. Let me say, put it in a kind way. Then you have the issue of recusal. And let me just define that for our listeners. If a judge has an interest in a case or a bias that she or he cannot set aside, they are obligated to remove themselves from the case and have an appointing authority, whether it's a state Supreme Court or whatever, appoint a visiting judge or another judge to come in and hear the case. Just, you know, within the last year, I was doing that. I was appointed by the Ohio Supreme Court to go around and sit where judges had a conflict of interest. They had a conflict, and I would go in as the neutral party to hear the case.
How kind.
Yes. But here we have two justices in particular who have displayed public sentiments that question their neutrality, and they don't recuse themselves from the most important cases coming before the Supreme Court, including the presidential immunity case that should be decided this coming Monday.
Now, isn't that the biggest, perhaps, slap in the face, right? It's not the fact that, or the idea that we're suggesting any judge or justice anywhere doesn't have an opinion or a feeling or a sentiment about a case. But you were very clear to say that where that feeling, opinion, or sentiment affects your neutrality, and in this instance, when you have now publicly articulated that bias or lack of neutrality, it kind of rings of an inability to be neutral. It kind of says pretty clear and upfront, yeah, I've picked a side already. So, you know, too bad, so sad. And it just harkens back to that idea that, you know, can you really trust the folks that we've now charged with making the decisions? And in addition to that, imagine, again, being the average person, and you are going through this experience every day, but you're also being reminded that these are lifetime appointments that are made in a political sphere that doesn't take your opinion into consideration. So you've not voted on it. Nobody's campaigned. Nobody's asked you. And you are powerless to do anything about it, because the ability to remove them is so very limited. You are essentially stuck with who you got, and you may not really care for the decisions that are being rendered by the people that you now have, and they are so far skewed against what it is that you believe. Imagine being the average person in society who now has to take all of this in and think about, my gosh, I did not realize how powerful this court was, but I also don't know that I realized how powerful the person is that puts the person there on the court. Because remember, the justices on the Supreme Court are more likely than not going to outlast any president that ever appoints them.
It's the longest lasting presidential decision ever.
Ever.
Because it transcends your term in office.
Indeed.
Anything you do can be undone by your successor, but this.
But this. But this. You cannot remove the justice. And so it really, it's that ice bath again, right? It's that shock to the system. It's that now understanding and appreciation that, oh my gosh, I guess you know, elections do have consequences, and who we put in certain offices really do make a difference. Everything from the president who nominates to the senators who confirm to ultimately the justices who, you know, may have provided certain assurances. I think every justice that went through a confirmation hearing that's currently seated on this Supreme Court, every one of them that went through a confirmation hearing absolutely committed during their confirmation hearings that Roe v. Wade was precedent on precedent and that it should not be disturbed until they were ultimately confirmed. And then we ultimately got the Dobbs decision. Does that perhaps make the, you know, folks a little uneasy about trusting this whole process? I think you've probably got Exhibit A right there about whether or not you feel like you can be confident in this process, or even if you can be confident in the decision-making of the senators who confirm the justices, because if they're the stopgap, if they are the ones who finally determine whether or not the person ascends to the court, then you might wonder, well, gosh, what is their decision-making? Because somebody should have protected us from what had been 5 decades of protected law that's now no more. And now we have a patchwork of precedent across the states that has made for a very challenging environment in many places throughout a country that didn't have this much chaos on this issue before. That's one thing I think folks are really looking at, is the impact.
Let's look at what can be done about the current situation where we have ethical concerns based on finances and appearances of impropriety, if not impropriety, and refusal to recuse oneself from key cases. What can be done?
Well, somebody's going to say that's just a bonus. They were just giving me bonuses.
Jump in here, but Congress, the House of Representatives, could vote to impeach a Supreme Court justice. That's not going to happen. One, it's a Republican-controlled House, and even if it were a Democratic House, it probably would not happen because there are no crimes or misdemeanors that we're talking about here. It is ethical considerations.
Right.
Before we get to the Senate, I want to focus on the Chief Justice. Now, you may tell that I'm intense about this.
No, not at all.
I worked at the Supreme Court of the United States for Chief Justice Rehnquist in his first year as Chief Justice. I was there for the transition from Chief Justice Warren Burger to Chief Justice Rehnquist, who was the predecessor of Chief Justice Roberts. I was a judicial fellow at the court, and the integrity of the court is in my DNA. It just pisses me off so badly that the integrity of the court is now rightfully questioned. So what can the Chief Justice do? Let me try to talk about that a minute. Yeah, the Chief Justice is the Chief Administrative Justice, has the same power as all the other 8 justices, but has some administrative power over the court. Now, how does that play out? Well, one of the things, the Chief Justice is the leader of the federal judiciary, all federal judges. And that is embodied by a group called the Judicial Conference of the United States. Now, I don't want to get too technical. It was created in 1922. It is a combination of judges from all of the circuits and all of the districts meet to regulate the behaviors of judges. In addition, they act and they propose legislation to enhance the federal judiciary. Who chairs that judicial conference? The Chief Justice of the United States, chairs that judicial conference. Now, in the past, the judicial conference has been, we'll take care of all the other federal judges, but you supremes, you take care of yourself. However, there are outspoken judges now who are members of the judicial conference who are saying, no, maybe if it applies to John Doe or Sally Smith in Ohio or Indiana as a federal judge, it ought to apply to Justice Alito and Justice Thomas, who are on the Supreme Court. It ought to apply to both. So could the Chief Justice go to the judicial conference and persuade them to take action that would impact on the Supreme Court? Yes, he could. Will he? No. Because I just recently wrote a column that said he needs a little blue pill of courage to counteract his leadership impotence. And that's truly the way I feel here. I think the Chief Justice has dropped the ball in trying to administer the court. Before there was the super conservative majority, he was the swing vote. And people on both sides, liberal and conservative, on the court paid attention to him. He had power. Now that there's this super conservative majority, they don't need him. Nobody's paying attention to him, and he hasn't stand up and demanded that they pay attention to him. What are your thoughts on that?
I genuinely believe that those judges that you're talking about, they aren't sitting back and asking, you know, will he or won't he? Because I think they know the answer to whether or not he will step up and impose these rules, these safeguards, because these safeguards protect the judges, the justices, as well as the public. But there, I think rightfully, the position is that he should, unequivocally, that there's the days of allowing them to govern themselves and to essentially write their own rules and to maybe even move the goalposts and shift the goalposts at will, that those days should come to an end, and swiftly so. But I like to think of this also, you know, from not just a current perspective, but also from a historical perspective, because just like I believe history will judge so many of our current leaders, that the Chief Justice won't be immune from that same experiment and that same outcome. History will judge him as well, because there's one thing to say, I wasn't aware, or I didn't know, or I had no way of becoming aware. But once you do become aware of all the things that you've outlined, right? And I mean, it's, the court's been leaking like a sieve. So it's not like these things are maintained in-house and the rest of the public is none too aware. But now that all of these things have come to light, as the Chief Justice, I would think that it would be embarrassing to have these things come to light at a time when he is the leader and he should demonstrate an ability to reinfuse faith in this justice system that is so necessary to democracy. Because remember, democracies only work as long as the people buy in. This isn't something that, you know, all of us are mandated to have. Democracy is a gift, but it is the gift that we all continue to buy into. And the judicial system is an important and integral cornerstone of buying into that. And we buy into that because we believe as a people that it provides an important, objective, necessary check on everything else that's going on. And so it is the natural check and balance of this system that was created all those centuries ago by our framers and the forefathers. But when you start having the fraying of trust, the erosion of trust to the degree that it is now at an all-time low. And one thing we didn't talk about was the option to expand the court, right?
Oh, we're going to get to that. So hold on to that thought.
But when you have that frame to the degree that we see it right now, what concerns me is that there certainly comes a time when people not only distrust the court, they've already started distrusting other parts of their own democracy. And if folks don't trust, they're not going to buy in. If they don't buy in, they're not going to cooperate. If they don't cooperate, then we're changing the whole texture of this. So much so that there, you know, unfortunately will come a time when we won't have the democracy that we originally envisioned. Now, we might have something that might look somewhat close to it, but won't be it. Or we may have something completely, totally different. What's worse, and I fear even worse than that, is the fact that what we see happening right now is so profound that we are going to be hard pressed to even invite, engage, or convince young people to tag into the game. We will have a hard time. We can't regenerate ourselves. You and I are retired, so we don't have to do this. Right? That means there are judges right now on the bench that we want them to keep doing a good job. And ultimately, we want them to pass the baton. But we're going to be hard pressed to sell this profession to others one or two generations down the road if there's this continued erosion of trust. And if that is the case, then oh my God, help us with who's going to be left. Because that really will be the breaking point. That's when the third pillar of democracy will absolutely crumble. You know, when you talked about recusal, it reminded me, you know, recusal is something that's so simple. It's not a blow to your ego as a judge. You can admit that, hey, listen, you know what? I've got a conflict here. I'm not going to be able to objectively hear this. Or you can truthfully say, hey, look, even if it appears to be a conflict, I can either overcome it or I can't, but I want to make sure that I'm being fair to folks. I know I
have. I want people to perceive that I am being fair, and that's why I'm removing myself.
And I want
from
both sides. I want both sides to know that. It's not that I am doing this to the benefit of one side or another. It is because both sides are owed the benefit of a fair adjudicator, and knowing that, even if again, this could, if someone were really maniacal, they could, you know, spin this wheel and play this and always call the judge, you know, biased, so that you could just get a certain judge removed. So it doesn't mean that there's always merit to the argument, but when the judge themselves know that this may be a meritorious argument, that there's something to this that actually may at least feed this perception of something being improper, then again, like I said, this isn't about being egotistical. Step aside, recuse, and allow the process to go forward without you. If it's the right outcome, you're going to get there no matter what. So don't worry about it. Now, I've certainly had experiences myself when, like, I've had a contempt, and you've probably had those too in your time.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, there's certainly times when, you know, judges would say, if you're going to hold the full contempt hearing, and it's happened even in during the Trump trials, is if you're going to, you know, hold a hearing because allegedly there are orders that haven't been followed, then yes, the argument can be made that, well, judge, since it was your order, then you're obviously going to be biased in favor of your own order. So you should probably recuse because the party's never going to get a fair shake under those circumstances. And I think that's a flawed argument because judges issue orders regularly. They issue them with the admonitions and expectations. And I had that same experience even with the chief of police in my old city. And I did not recuse because of the idea that the order was issued. we all knew what the rules were, and we're going to have a fair hearing. But again, that's not always the case. If there is a situation where clearly it is improper, or there is that perception of impropriety that you're not going to give the other side a fair shake, then check your ego at the door, hang it up with your robe for the moment, and step aside and let a colleague handle it. Because again, the right outcome is going to be reached, whether it's you or whether it's somebody else, if it's really the right outcome. And that's what's so disappointing here, because the justices could step aside and we could still have a lot more faith in the process and probably start reinfusing faith in the process if we saw a little bit more of this. Without seeing it, people just lose faith all over again.
So what we're having now is what's left, and the last thing I want to talk about today is what can the Senate do? We talked about the House and impeachment, and that's not going to happen. What can the Senate do? Well, the Senate is talking now about creating a code of ethics and making it enforceable on the court. That is extremely problematic, because of the whole concept of separation of powers. As much as I want the court to regulate, I want the court to regulate itself, mm-hmm. not have the Senate or Congress regulate it, because that's the legislative branch dipping in and regulating the behavior of the judicial branch. To me, that's a clear violation of the separation of powers that we have as the foundation in our country. The other thing, however, that the Senate can do, and this is allowed by the Constitution, is to change the number of justices on the court, which would expand the number of justices there and perhaps even the playing field from this highly conservative area, or it could be a highly liberal area. You could use the expansion to bring it more towards the middle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's being talked about more and more. Senator Warren from Massachusetts was promoting that this week in one of her stops in Wisconsin.
And the rebalancing or realigning of the court, I think, has been something that's been a topic of discussion for, maybe the last 3 or 4 years or so. I think certainly since at least the beginning of this current administration, with also the caveat and the concern, right, that if in fact it is expanded under the current political party, the Democratic Party, then as America swings back and forth to providing each party at some point its time in office in the executive branch, then what's going to happen is when Republicans become the majority party, then they're going to expand it more. And so is there no end to court expansion in order to either maintain majority or create majorities? I certainly understand the argument of creating that balance or rebalancing the court so that it is reflective of the ideals of the American people that are impacted by it. But it also begs the question of to what end? If there is an additional, 3 seats or 4 seats this administration, then the next administration may seek to add 2 more seats or 5 more seats.
And yeah, where does it end?
And before you know it, we've got a 50-seat Supreme Court or a 58 or a 53-seat Supreme Court. Who knows? But there is no real end to it. So you don't want to start what you can't stop. It. This can become a bit of a Pandora's box.
And all of this goes back to public perception, as we've been talking about as we started and as we ended. For the court to be effective, it has no army. It has no police force to go out and enforce its orders. It has to have public respect. And the fact that that's being eroded at such a high level and so quickly gives me real pause as to the ultimate effect of the rule of law in this country and the role of the rule of law in this country.
Well said.
Well, maybe next time we'll talk about the mechanics of the court at some point in the future. Next time, we're probably going to be talking about the sentencing coming up for President Trump on July 11th in New York for former President Trump. That's July 11th. So our next episode will probably be focusing on that. But Judge Gale, we've had people contact us. One person wants us to do a show on habeas corpus. I think that would be a really interesting show.
Let's do it.
Somebody wants us to delve in more to the case that we've really been giving short shrift to, and that is the case, the Mar-a-Lago case.
Classified documents.
The Judge Aileen Cannon's rulings and hearings and what all that means. And there seems to be great confusion about that we can clear up. And some people want us to delve into that. So we've got a lot of things on the agenda to clear up. But I appreciate you allowing me to vent today, because this is really something that's near and dear to my heart, and I think should be near and dear to every American, is the sanctity of the Supreme Court of the United States.
Absolutely, and certainly its interconnectedness to every other court that every other listener will experience. So you may never have a case to appear before the United States Supreme Court, but your perception of those justices no doubt trickle down to and impact how you see, how you treat, how you understand, how you respect your local judge or your state judges. And that all matters. And having these conversations to help illuminate these things and even talk candidly about them, I hope helps to at least begin to restore some of that faith, at least from the perspective of two judges that are willing to have very transparent conversations about maybe shortcomings and also opportunities to help rebuild faith in the people that we hope and expect will abide by our rulings. So thank you all for listening. And don't forget to check us out on every podcast platform where you get your podcasts, and make sure to like and subscribe.
And rate and review, as you always say, right? Rate and review.
Yes, rate and review and like and subscribe.
We want to thank you for listening to this episode of Next Witness Please. You can subscribe, as Judge Gale said, to Next Witness Please at almost any of your favorite podcast outlets, but specifically iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Music Podcasts, Audible. We're on Audible now, and the NPR National Public Radio Podcast Directory. If you have a question or comment or a suggestion for a show that you would like for us to do, please send it to me by email. You can do that at hodson@ohio.edu. That's Hodson, H-O-D-S-O-N, @ohio.edu. Next Witness Please is produced through the auspices of WOUB Public Media at Ohio University. Colin Cameron is our co-producer and our audio engineer. Judge Gale and I will be back very soon to talk about the upcoming sentencing of President Trump and to give you more insights into the law and perhaps insights into judicial thinking about sentencing. With that, have a good day, everyone.
Take care, folks. Till next time.